This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Commodities, the sub-minimum wage, and the lingering impact of World War II. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdal. It's Monday, December 28th. Good to have you with us. The world's largest publicly traded copper mining company had a terrible, no-good day today. Arizona-based Freeport-McMoRan saw its founder and executive chairman step down this morning. Its stock fell nearly 10%. And here's the thing. Freeport-McMoRan in the last few years has diversified from metals and minerals into oil and gas. But when all the world's commodities go bust at the same time, you gotta know that terrible no-good day is coming. From our sustainability desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Jim Bob Moffat co-founded one of the two companies that eventually became Freeport-McMoRan. It grew into a copper mining giant and then diversified into oil and gas 2 years ago, just in time for all commodities to crash and for him to bow out. Chuck Bradford is with the investment firm Bradford Research.
We haven't had a cycle that I can recall where everything went down at the same time. I mean, even the soft commodities, most of the grains have the same kind of chart pattern as the hard commodities.
In 2015, nearly half of all corporate defaults were in the commodities sector. Why? Well, most raw materials are traded in U.S. dollars, and the dollar is strong, which means buyers abroad have weak currencies, weak purchasing power, they buy less. And, says Bradford, China is buying less.
It had to slow down. It's basically the law of big numbers. You can't keep growing at better than 10% growth rate indefinitely.
Prices of metals and minerals and oil have all swung down violently. Oil executive and economics professor Ed Herz at the University of Houston explains that when there's a glut of a commodity, the extra tends to just sit there as the price falls. No one wants it.
If there's an extra gallon of oil lying around outside your tank, once you filled up with 15 gallons, that 16th gallon, you don't give any value to it.
So for now, mining companies like Freeport-McMoRan have to suffer until prices come back up. 2 months ago, the CEO of the company stole this lyric from a country western song. If you're going through hell, keep on going. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
There's an idea that surfaces from time to time in the national debate over whether the minimum wage ought to be raised. The idea is a sub-minimum wage for low-skilled or younger hourly workers. Well, it turns out there already is a sub-minimum wage for a different group of employees, and it's about to go through some changes. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
The subminimum wage was part of the Fair Labor Standards Act passed during the Depression. Brad Hirschbein is an economist at the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. He says the idea was to make disabled workers more appealing.
So that they would have opportunities while employers would not have to pay a rate of pay that they could not justify based on the productivity of those employees.
So how's that worked out? Depends on who you ask. Talk to Curtis Decker, and he'll tell you the subminimum wage leads to the exploitation of disabled workers, and we should get rid of it eventually. Decker heads the National Disability Rights Network.
This is an example, I think, of a disability policy that was well-intentioned 80 years ago and has kind of lost its effectiveness and its purpose.
Congress agreed and passed the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. President Obama signed it about 18 months ago. The government is still figuring out the rules, but Decker says the idea is to put disabled teens in regular jobs and not shunt them into sub-minimum wage jobs. But nonprofits who employ them at the lower wage say, not so fast.
Don't throw out the baby with the bathwater.
That's Leanne Fox, a lobbyist for Access, a trade group for nonprofits employing the disabled. She says proposed rules requiring them to employ non-disabled workers could put them out of business and deprive disabled workers of a job.
It gives them something that they can have as their own, where they're earning a paycheck. There's a pride and a sense of self-worth.
Economist Hirschbein says it's worth tinkering with the subminimum wage, but it's not clear that getting rid of it entirely is the answer. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders didn't like what was going on in the energy sector, not one little bit. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's been more than 70 years since the end of World War II, and just this week, Japan and South Korea reached an agreement to resolve a dispute over Korean women who served as sex slaves for Japan's military. They're known as comfort women. Only about 45 of these women are still living. Japan officially apologized. It's offered up an $8.3 million payment. James Person studies Korean history at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So both countries here say this is the final resolution of this issue. But will an official apology and $8.3 million really put this to rest?
This is actually, it has a very long history. There was an agreement in 1965 that was supposed to have put it to rest. It was done under the table. Korean people didn't really know about it. In fact, the Korean people didn't even know about the sex slave issue until the 1990s, when former victims actually came out. There have been apologies in the past that didn't put it to rest, primarily because the apologies weren't seen as being genuine. So I think it's a tremendous step.
Why is this happening now?
Well, both President Park Geun-hye of South Korea and Prime Minister Abe of Japan had expressed some months ago that they wanted to have this resolved within 2015. And there are a number of security issues that are of great importance to both countries and to, of course, the United States. China's growing assertiveness in the region. There is a greater need for the two nations to cooperate.
The U.S. has also pushed for resolution on this. Why has the U.S. gotten involved?
Well, because Korea and Japan are such important strategic allies to the United States, you know, and it was deeply troubling to the United States to see two of its closest allies, not just in the region, but in the world, not talking to one another. It was clearly in the U.S., in U.S. interests to get this matter resolved so that, you know, you can have more strategic cooperation.
If the relationship between Japan and South Korea does get back on track, what are the economic implications of that partnership?
The interesting thing is they've both been pretty pragmatic all along to a remarkable degree. There's a lot of economic and cultural back and forth between Japan and Korea. It's not as if, you know, relations were at a standstill. But we can hope for even greater economic cooperation.
I've read that some of these women who are sex slaves are unhappy with this agreement, saying it doesn't reflect their wishes. And I wonder, what else would they like to see?
I mean, it's nearly impossible, I think, to give them, you know, complete solace. I see it as an end to the ongoing debate and the efforts to get an official apology. But the starting point for this period of reflection, you know, and it's a refresh button, I think, for the relationship between Japan and Korea.
James Person from the Woodrow Wilson Center, thanks so much.
Thank you.
creating weather havoc around the globe. Record flooding in Britain, record warm temperatures in the U.S., forest fires in Australia. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says it's one of the strongest El Niños in recorded history. And here in Southern California, there's a whole lot of hand-wringing, waiting for the predicted downpours. There's a lot of worry about floods and mudslides, and also damage to trees. Marketplace's Andy Euler reports.
When you drive into the Hollywood Hills, you'd be hard-pressed to go more than a few blocks without seeing a giant palm frond in the street or along the sidewalk. Winds pick up steam and travel down the mountains. We're talking gusts of more than 50 miles an hour. If you got dead trees shredding branches next to your house, winds like that could mean some serious destruction. That risk is making Nick Araya a busy man. He owns Tree Care LA.
Our schedule is booked out like crazy. We're getting tons of calls every day from people that have trees, big or small, that they're worried about.
Like the 80-year-old avocado tree in the backyard at Helena Lipstadt's place. I had no idea avocado trees could get this big. She and Nick walk around the tree, and she asks him what he thinks.
The farthest reach of the branches, those feel to me very vulnerable. This and the one above it and those came crashing down. That could break a window.
If things up here fall, they're falling straight down. Most likely in a big storm, not when you guys are standing here, it would be extremely unlikely for them to fall and then bounce into the house, though it could happen. Trees do goofy things sometimes.
Nick tells me a lot of his job is risk management, reading people and understanding how much of it they're willing to tolerate. He says some tree lovers won't even get rid of a tree if it poses a significant threat to their property. He's consulted with a number of homeowners in the neighborhood and takes me around.
We're driving to a Torrey pine tree that is almost 100 feet tall. There it is right there. This is a tree that obviously the homeowners were really concerned about for storms. Because it's just gigantic and there isn't a good way for this tree to fall. All right, so these are two sycamore trees. The bigger one is almost 4 feet in diameter. They lean away from each other, and the big one leans right over the top of a very old house.
The owner didn't want to get rid of the trees. Nick says he doesn't blame him. The trees are healthy and they add a lot of character. And taking them out? No, only between $20,000 and $30,000. Our last stop is Ruth Sugarman's house. Now, hers is an interesting scenario. She's worried about two sweet gum trees between her house and the sidewalk. They're actually the city's trees.
They don't really do much of anything for them.
Sugarman and her husband have been living here for 40 years, and she says she considers the trees theirs.
I mean, they're on our property, and trees are important, so we figured that we're responsible for making them safe.
And it's also unlikely the city's going to pick up the tab if a limb happens to fall on one of their cars. Sugarman says she's happy to pay a little extra to have Nick and his crew come out to make her situation a little bit safer. And apparently, others in Los Angeles are too. Tree Care LA's next available appointment? Late January. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up?
Well, when Robert McNamara came in to the Pentagon at the beginning of the Kennedy administration, he had just come from Ford Motor Company. And one of his marching orders was to make the Pentagon more efficient.
The perils of the government trying to act like a big business. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gave up 23 points, 0.1%, to end the day at 17,528. The Nasdaq slipped 7 points, also 0.1%, to finish at 5040. The S&P 500 fell 4 points, 0.2%, closing at 2056. Let's hope everyone who got a Fitbit for Christmas asked for a Fitbit for Christmas. Lots of people apparently got them. The Fitbit app was number one download over the weekend. Fitbit shares, they stepped up 3.2%. Michael Pearson, the CEO who turned Valiant Pharmaceuticals into a company that buys other pharma companies, went on medical leave with severe pneumonia. Valiant shares off 1.1%. We told you about Freeport MacMoran's bad day. It closed down 9.5%, off nearly 70% for 2015 so far. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.23%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is listener-supported, so please, to keep our coverage relevant and compelling, make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount counts twice thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. Help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at Marketplace.org by December 31st, and thanks.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Conference Board issues its monthly Consumer Confidence Index. Preparations in Pasadena continue for the annual Rose Parade on New Year's Day. Can't wait! The parade bands perform field shows for the next 2 days. And December is National Eggnog Month. You have a few more days to fill any holiday calorie deficits you may be experiencing. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdal. Disney, in its largest expansion ever, will create a Star Wars land at its California theme park. That'll mean tearing down much of its Wild West-themed frontier land. As Marketplace's Sabri Benishaw reports, this is about competition and cultural change.
In the amusement park industry, there is magic. Universal's Harry Potter themed parks. And there's the Force. Disney's planned Star Wars-themed attractions.
It is a fairly intense rivalry.
Martin Lewison is assistant professor of business management at Farmingdale State College in New York. Disney still dominates, but Universal is gaining.
They've been getting 15-20% increases in Florida thanks to the Harry Potter attractions. That really woke Disney up.
So Disney expanded Fantasyland in Florida. Now Universal is going to open up a Harry Potter in California. Now Disney is responding with Star Wars.
Now this is a bi-coastal arms race. Disney wants to strike while the lightsaber is hot.
To make room, Disney is clearing out most of its Wild West-themed attractions in Disneyland.
Our interest in the West has definitely been cyclical, but it seems to be at a fairly low cycle right now.
Grace Hale chairs the American Studies program at the University of Virginia. She says this says a lot of things about our current shared imagination as a culture.
The Western is a very white male fantasy and has been historically.
The U.S. and its image of itself are both far more textured and diverse than the Western fantasy, which just resonates less for now.
There are very few things that actually cut across all of those niches.
But lightsabers and wands do, for now. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishaw for Marketplace.
A half century ago, Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara decided to start running the Pentagon more like a business. He created the Defense Logistics Agency, which is now a $44 billion a year operation, tasked with buying pretty much everything the military might need. Diamonds, airplane parts, pharmaceuticals. Turns out the Pentagon might not know exactly where all these things are or why it has so many of some of them. And now Congress has demanded its first financial audit of the Pentagon. Brian Binder is Politico's national security correspondent. He's the author of an investigative report titled, How Do You Buy $7 Billion of Stuff You Don't Need? Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I wonder if we can start with the history of the Defense Logistics Agency. Why didn't McNamara think it was the right way to go, and how did it get as big as it is today?
Well, when Robert McNamara came into the Pentagon at the beginning of the Kennedy administration, he had just come from Ford Motor Company. And one of his marching orders was to make the Pentagon more efficient. And one of the ways he did that was to consolidate the Pentagon's approach to buying everyday items, so consumables, as they would call them, everything from toilet paper to food to uniforms to gasoline, things that all of the military branches were purchasing, but at that point were often doing on their own. And his idea was if we have some central purchasing agent, we'll get an economies of scale, and this stuff will be cheaper. But over the years, it just grew into this behemoth. The intent was quite understandable and quite rational. The problem is if you're going to run the Pentagon like a business, you don't necessarily have the kind of people with business experience to run it effectively. And so here we are 54 years later, and the Defense Logistics Agency is about to go through its first ever financial audit in 2016.
What are some of the hurdles it'll face passing this audit?
Well, the DLA's been preparing for this audit for about 3 years, and they've done a series of mock audits, and they've learned a lot, as the senior agency officials have said. They've uncovered a lot of problems. I mean, one major problem is just simply the paperwork nightmare. How do you provide an independent auditor, in this case, an outside firm that comes in with all of the paper trail so they can have confidence that you know where the money is, you know where your inventory is, you know where you bought it from, who you bought it from, who you bought it for. And so I think getting their paperwork system and their computer systems, which are many and varied, kind of on the same page has been a huge challenge.
So they don't have this paper trail.
Well, they claim that they have enough of a paper trail now that they think they could pass an independent audit. But they will clearly admit, as the deputy finance director told me, you know, you'd think it would be easy to track a fire truck. But that was one example of the paper says we have it. We bought it. But God knows where it is.
Wow.
What military base is it on? Did we sell it? Was it extra? And so, you know, just tracking all of that has been a huge, huge endeavor. And, you know, and I think a lot of people think they've come far in 3 years. But the big test is now when you have a KPMG or another big outside auditing firm, and the Pentagon is about to decide who that will be, to come in and say, okay, you know, here's whether you pass or you don't pass. And I think there's big questions as to whether they're really ready for that.
As they've gotten ready for this audit, what else have they uncovered about their own practices or what they're doing right or wrong?
One of the things they've learned is that it's one thing to do an audit. In other words, it's one thing to get a snapshot in time of what your books look like, what comes in, what goes out. But it's a whole nother challenge to figure out whether what you bought is actually what you need. In the end, even if DLA passes a financial audit and the books look relatively good, it doesn't solve what many people think is a larger problem, which is simply buying things the military doesn't need. It's not a stretch to say this is the Walmart of the Pentagon. The problem is it's not really run like Walmart.
If it were run like Walmart, would this work? How do you fix it?
I think some would say you perhaps need to privatize this a little bit more. Maybe you take this government-run business and allow private industry to have a bigger role in actually running it. But I think others would argue that there really isn't an easy solution because the military obviously needs very unique items. Sometimes it needs them very quickly, and you sort of need a central purchaser who can go out and get this stuff and can also move it around the world as needed. And so is there a way we can bring in more of these business practices that industry is using these days to at least get some of the costs down and to at least reduce the cases of buying things that aren't needed? I don't think anybody thinks you're ever going to fix that problem completely, but at least maybe there are things that can be done to get it under control.
Brian Binder is Politico's national security correspondent. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
The Philippines has been classified as one of the places most at risk from the effects of global warming. The BBC's Fergus Nickel reports on what that means to people who live there.
When a super typhoon hit the Philippines 2 years ago, the world's attention was focused on the crisis. 6,300 people were killed and more than 1 million homes were damaged by the storm, known locally as Yolanda. But since then, a number of deadly typhoons have battered the archipelago. Flaviano Hilario is from the National Weather Bureau, PAGASA.
People are asking whether Typhoon Yolanda is already a manifestation of climate change. And we can see that based on historical records, the wind speed recorded by Yolanda, this is actually the strongest so far to affect the Philippines.
Dr. Jane Rovins runs a disaster risk consultancy. She says the world's media tends to concentrate on the big disasters, but in the Philippines, there are long-term problems.
What we miss are these yearly events that can be just as devastating to a small community, because if you have a Category 1 storm come through and it brings a lot of rain, it can be just as damaging as a fast-moving Category 5. If you get hit over and over and over in a very short period of time, the impacts are just monumental.
So how are people coping? I visited farms in Nueva Ecija, an area north of the capital hit badly by the last typhoon in October. Rice farmers there lost two-thirds of their crop as well as their livestock. One farmer I met, Antonio Pablo, was trying to harvest what he could from a field that just a few weeks before was inundated with water.
This is my farmland, about 400 square meters of land. I used to harvest 25 sacks of rice here every harvest time, but I'm afraid that I won't be able to harvest 10 sacks of rice now. I was hoping that at least I can harvest something my family and I can cook and eat. Having something to cook for our food is better than nothing.
The head of the Philippines Red Cross, Richard Gordon, says the government in Manila just isn't acting quickly enough. He compared the situation with the United States before the establishment of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA.
That was the BBC's Fergus Nicol. Lots of folks had the week off last week, lounging around with their families, watching football, and baking and eating probably too many cookies. But for some, the weeks before Christmas are among the very busiest time of the year. Marketplace's Tobin Lowe talked to a freelance violinist who earns a significant part of her yearly income playing Handel's Messiah.
The most Messiahs I ever did in one year was 12. And this was when I was a student, had nothing to eat. I was eating rice and beans for a year, and I don't know how I fit 12 messiahs into one season, but I made it work. My name is Tally Brunfelt. I live in Inwood in Manhattan, and I'm a freelance violinist and have been for the last 10 years. The holidays are fantastic to be a working musician. I have more work than I know what to do with. The last 3 weeks from Thanksgiving to, you know, the week before Christmas, I would say it's 30 concerts within 2 weeks. I have stress dreams about not showing up for a gig. Luckily, that hasn't happened yet, but there's a first time for everything, so hopefully it won't happen this year. It's an interesting thing to try and keep things fresh, especially something that you have to play over and over and over in the holiday season. Some days I just don't want to play, but I have to. But I actually really enjoy all of the holiday music that I play.
That was produced by Marketplace's Tobin Lowe. This final note. Turns out those Lego sets you got for your kids, or maybe for yourself, for the holidays this year, may be a pretty solid investment. According to an analysis by The Telegraph, Lego sets have grown more in value over the last 15 years than the FTSE 100 stock market or the gold market. The Telegraph estimates the average Lego set has gained 12% a year since 2000. But you're only going to get that kind of return if the sets are unopened and unplayed with. And what's the fun in that? All right, that's our show. Today, the Dow gave up 23 points, 0.1%. The Nasdaq slipped 7 points, 0.1%. And the S&P 500 fell 4 points, 0.2%. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Adrian Hill. We'll be back again tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.